When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening, it's 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Juliana Gonsalves. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie. Let's start off with your local news headlines. A group of medical students at Queen's University are organizing action aimed at addressing housing and homelessness in Kingston. While it's called the Queen's Medicine Municipal Day of Action, the work has been underway for weeks. Students have been meeting with local service providers, community organizations, and experts, and are now bringing their findings directly to city councilors. The last time the event was held was in 2021, also focusing on housing and homelessness. This year marks a five-year follow-up, as homelessness in Kingston has risen by 133% over that period. First-year medical student Zara Rahman and second-year student Tim Song spoke with CFRC about how the initiative came together.
So this initiative is called the Medical Day of Action, or the Municipal Medical Day of Action, and it is run by a team of medical students right here at Queen's. There are a lot of similar initiatives that happen all across Canada, whether it's through province, whether it's through the entire nation, where we meet up in Ottawa. And we wanted to do something more local here in Kingston as a group of medical students. So the Medical Student Society, also called the Aesculapian Society, has a group of medical students who are specifically working towards equity and advocacy as a committee. And these medical students work independently to do different things around Kingston and around Queens to try to make a difference. For example, we host fundraisers. For example, we host different awareness events. And this year, we want to bring back an event that's happened previously at Queens, the School of Medicine, called the Day of Action. So that's kind of how it came to be.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is the first time this has come back since 2021. I was wondering if you could speak to why you decided to bring it back now and why revisit this topic.
Yes, for sure. So this initiative used to be a lot bigger pre-COVID, where people were able to meet in person. Basically, as a quick overview of what a day of action is it basically is a bunch of medical students or health professionals looking through the community, whether it's municipal, provincial, or national, like I stated before, to see if there's any issues that as medical students or health professionals, we could address. So this was a lot easier to do, as you can imagine, to try to talk to city councilors or talk to municipal government in person. So over COVID, it kind of died down. But just as an example of a few different things that the Kingston team used to work on includes water fluoridation, very important. We don't have that here in Kingston, as well as homelessness relief or housing for the precariously housed, which is, again, a very pertinent issue here in the Kingston community. So as things got back to coming in person and we started having more lively discussions about how we can make a change here at Queen's, the first thing we kind of stumbled upon was this program called Municipal Day of Action. And as we were looking back at past references, talking to past organizers to see what would be a good fit for us moving forward, we found that the topic that they addressed in 2021, housing and homelessness, would be a perfect fit based on all of the pertinent issues that are happening here in Kingston today.
And to add on, we felt like it was very important in the times that we're in right now. So since 2021, homelessness in Kingston has risen. And we've also seen that there are a lot of different barriers. And I think even looking at this politically on how much of this becomes a pertinent topic, this is something that is continuously discussed. And we felt that it may be best for us as medical students to advocate for our future patients, especially considering all the different barriers and how health, there's so much more research coming out now, especially since COVID, on how the social determinants of health. So for those who don't know, those are kind of just factors in your life, like income or housing, and how much that can actually impact your health. It's not usually just, exercise or diet. It can also be where you live, how much money you have, what access to resources you have. And we found, at least through our research, that with homelessness rising in Kingston, there's also a reduction in those health outcomes as well. And then that could also tie into other issues like wait times in hospitals, for example, in emergency wait times, for example. So we kind of looked at this more holistically as we went throughout our research.
From their consultations, the group developed two key asks for council, focused on improving housing services and health outcomes for unhoused residents. The first calls for better data collection and coordination across services.
When you approach a topic like homelessness, you can consider the so many different layers. There was a point where we considered addictions. There was a point where we considered home standards, for example. And there's just so many layers, but we kind of did a more of a deep dive into the research. We looked into health outcomes. We looked into how different municipalities approach this. And one thing we found, as Tim mentioned, was data and the importance of it. So when we did the deep dive, we looked into, so United Way, for example, in Kingston does a lot of data checks. So there's something called the by name list. So not going into the specifics because it is quite complex, but basically the by name list identifies individuals who are unhoused in Kingston. And these are individuals that are comfortable being recognized and has all of their data, and it allows us to keep track on them and make sure that they're okay. And the way that the city of Kingston does it right now is that they just list how many people are unhoused. So for example, I believe currently it's over 500 in 2025. But as we've mentioned before, there are a lot of barriers to that data, and it may not give the full holistic idea of what's going on, and that can impact what policies we're able to provide in Kingston. So the ask that we have right now is to make sure that that data, so the by name list, or there's something called the Homeless Individuals and Families Information System, has a good idea of who is being unhoused and then who is being housed, so inflow and outflow. And this is important to have, you know, for example, either on housing for homelessness, like as an annual report, just to make sure we have an idea as the city to know where people are at, where folks are at, and to see what different barriers they're experiencing. And then also having a good monthly report card. So I believe it was either United Way or one of the community organizations that did an evaluation on the data and the situation of homelessness in Kingston. And they found that, unfortunately, the data is just not as well upkept in Kingston. So there is that gap. They reported this as being a huge barrier. I believe it's only updated monthly. And sometimes there can be difficulties in recognizing who's being housed and who's not being unhoused. Because when you're living, for example, on the street, and then you were housed and then now you're not housed, that's a day by day. You're surviving day by day, not month by month. So we also looked into other jurisdictions. One, for example, is in Hamilton and the Durham District as well. So in Hamilton, what they do is that they have a lot of comprehensive data. So they not only provide like how many people are unhoused in Kingston, but how many people were housed, how many people are, for example, of different marginalized communities, how many of them are women, how many of them are Indigenous, and then how many of those have been approached, for example, by someone to get housed. So I think that provides more of a realistic idea of what's going on the ground versus just these are how many people are unhoused. And I think that can really benefit, one, the government, the municipal government, especially just to figure out when you are coming up with policies, what support you can give. But also, I think for the people of Kingston, I think that this would allow for a lot more grace and I think a lot more empathy if you just have an idea of what someone is experiencing and the different layers of it versus just seeing a number. Because we as individuals are not just numbers. We all have different stories. And I think having that data would be able to have that better picture of what's going on.
Yeah, for sure. I think keeping in mind that the residents of Kingston really value safety and really value community, we want to also emphasize that. And it can also often feel for different community members if they don't have access to this data or don't know what's happening, all they see is that numbers are increasing. Yeah. They're going to feel disheartened. They're going to feel like the city's not doing enough, or they're going to feel like the city's efforts are futile. By having these metrics like the inflow and outflow data more specifically outlined, then the people of Kingston can understand, oh, looks like the different things that are being put into place are actually meaningful. They're helping people get back on their feet and back to transitioning into community living. And this will hopefully provide more of a stable relationship between the city building committees as well as the communities as well. So that's kind of what we're aiming for with this ask.
Yeah. And then also we mentioned before, but we had so many discussions about what are the different factors to homelessness. Like I've mentioned before, there was like a huge gripe with us for like at least a few weeks of figuring out what direction to take. And I think that kind of explains of how we're approaching homelessness in Kingston. We don't truly know what are the different factors right now. Like we can definitely estimate it based on like what research says, but having that publicly available dashboard or that public data allows us to just kind of understand what are the different factors. And for the folks at home that might be wondering, okay, but like how does this matter? Well, for example, the by name list, so those are the guides, and they can, one, develop those policies, but two, in places like Hamilton, for example, they have the by name list, and then they have a little subset group of people who are at most or at risk, and then they are able to provide those individuals from that subset to specific housing resources. And I think that is an idea of where we would love to go, where we could look at this. And again, looking beyond just the numbers, but seeing how we can better support people with what resources we have.
Their second ask emphasizes incorporating Indigenous housing models into local approaches.
So as medical students, we often see, or we often try to look at which populations are more vulnerable or more susceptible to different health issues. It's the social determinants of health that Zara talked about earlier. And the thing that we, I guess, focused on this year was the sheer number or a sheer disproportionate number of Indigenous individuals who are experiencing homelessness, not just in Kingston, but globally. And we thought that this disproportionate effect was something that maybe we could look into Kingston more specifically in to see if there's a way to help provide support for this more vulnerable population. So in order to do this, we talked to a lot of different community groups here in Kingston itself. We had a conversation with the Language Nest. We talked to 4D. We talked to the Ikanu Patient Services, which is a group that works up with the James Bay Indigenous folk and bringing them back and forth with KGH. And basically, we've decided that we want to ask for more Indigenous-led housing, culturally grounded prevention services, wraparound supports, and basically just strengthening the city of Kingston's truth and reconciliation commitments. So all this to say, for both ask and ask two, for ask one and ask two, the city has been doing amazing work. Mm-hmm. When we talk to some of the different organizations like the Canadian Association for Ending Homelessness, they listed that Kingston is doing a great job in addressing homelessness. So again, for the second ask, it's kind of more of a push towards you're doing a great job towards supporting Indigenous initiatives. We want to see more. We want you to keep doing what you're doing and kind of push that forward. So a few different ways that, again, it's a very broad ask. Support, strengthen truth and reconciliation commitments. Very broad, very abstract, if that makes sense. So a few different ways that we're kind of hoping that could go about its way could potentially be continuing to invest in more Indigenous-led supportive transitional housing initiatives. So we had a conversation with Tipi Moza, mm-hmm. which is the supportive housing, one of the main supportive housing organizations here in Kingston. And they suggested that one aspect of supportive housing that could be important was maybe having more Indigenous-specific housing centers or complexes. Right now, the Language Nest is working on helping individuals who identify as Indigenous to find housing or put in applications. And by having a center that's specifically investing in more Indigenous-led supportive housing would be really beneficial to the community at large. Another way could do this would be to increase municipal funding. Mm-hmm. Another way could do this could be to look at how the Indigenous Community Land Trust I guess fits into the implementation of different strategies for building housing in the future, and potentially looking into an Indigenous care center, which basically means working with the local Indigenous partners like the Language Nest to identify a site, maybe funding pathways and implementation timelines to move basically a comprehensive care center forward.
Yeah. And to add on, we felt that, like, for example, from our conversations with Tipi Moza, that the city is doing amazing stuff. And Tipi Moza has been, you know, doing a lot of groundbreaking work. A lot of communities outside of Kingston sometimes want to come to Kingston because of the access to services due to Tipi Moza's amazing work. And we want to frame this in encouraging this amazing work just because, especially in a time of budget cuts. So we found, for example, with recently with the federal government's budget cuts, there has been a huge reduction in services that will be negatively impacting a lot of these community organizations. I believe it was the NEST specifically, that the language NEST specifically, where there might be a lot of reduction in what supportive services they are able to provide. And I think that in these times where a lot of folks are probably deciding, what can we support? What can we not support? What is in our budget? I think that's where we are at politically. And I think it is so important for us to encourage the amazing services because we are able to see the benefits they're having on, especially in Indigenous peoples and especially those experiencing homelessness and that intersectionality between those two marginalized communities. And I think that is something that we really wanted to emphasize. So if there ever comes a time in the future where there has to be a decision made, or if there is budget cuts in the future, we want to be there saying that, hey, just remember all these different individuals who you are supporting, who may be impacted by any other future decisions that you do make. Please keep this in mind.
Students are now meeting with city councilors throughout the month of April and hope to bring the conversation to the provincial level as well. Ramon and Song say they've already been getting a response from the Kingston community.
From those initial conversations, I think a lot of folks were really happy that we were talking about. They were really, the reactions that I've received was a lot of hope and a lot of just hoping that things can get better and a lot of gratefulness as well that people were looking into this, especially as medical professionals. And from the physicians that we've spoken with in our class. So, for example, I did an announcement and one of our professors was talking to our class about how important it is to discuss the social determinants of health, to look at medicine outside of just what we learn in a lecture hall, but rather, and just slides, but rather the lived experiences of individuals. And then we've heard that echoed from our peers as well. So a lot of our peers have been approaching us, like a lot of folks, for example, in the first year class have approached me about how excited they are for this initiative to be able to make a difference and to also want to join this initiative if they haven't, like, you know, gotten the chance to. And I think that this shows a lot of optimism and hope that is kind of missing from the public discourse recently. I think things have been really down and sucky for the past few years just with how, I don't know, like how life has been. And I think that this offers a lot of hope and glimmer of optimism that a lot of medical students are approaching with and a lot of faculty members and community members are approaching with.
I would also say that humility has been a big aspect of our community consultation, especially as it's been a lot of learning as we talk to all these amazing organizations and speaking about all the very important and invaluable work that they've done.
Looking ahead as the group dives into conversations with counselors, the group hopes this work will have a positive impact in the Kingston community and continue to grow as an ongoing initiative within Queen's Medicine.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see where this will go. I think that one of the things that really excited me when I first wanted to bring back this event as one of the co-chairs of the Equity and Access Committee was the fact that medical students could have so much fun learning and being so involved in the community as Queen's medical students with Kingston. I feel a lot of the times that Queen's itself feels like a big bubble where we're just nestled into downtown, not really focusing on anything else that happens in Kingston. And the School of Medicine is a smaller bubble embedded within the bigger bubble where we don't even talk to oftentimes the rest of Queens. So I think that this way, having an outlet for people to be able to contribute to the community or learn about the community through advocacy and equity, which are big foundational, I guess, skill sets that medicine or doctors needs, I think is such a great way to, I guess, be connected and understand what's going on, not only with Kingston, but also with our own beliefs and values. I think that this will hopefully be an initiative that continues to grow, not only for medical students, but also for Kingston itself.
I believe, for example, if we are able to make a difference in the community that we're in, that is already one stroke forward to making a difference elsewhere. And I think that is my hope, that we continue this effort in continuing to build that advocacy, the passion in a lot of students, because our team has been really, really passionate about this and the community has been really passionate about this. So I think that is my one hope for this. And I'm thinking on a more long-term perspective, one, that we're able to help the community that we are part of to hopefully make a difference and be able to address some of those, for example, those ideas, those numbers that we addressed at the beginning of this talk and see how we can support in that front. But also, I think like developing a culture within Queens Medicine, but even other medical schools, for example, or even within Queens, on how important it is for us to support our own community and be responsible for our own community. It goes down to that very basic idea of humanity that I think is always echoed in, you know, the humanities, medicine, but any field where you help someone that is in need because you are a human being and that person matters. And the benefit of another person is a benefit for myself as well. So I think that is one thing that we hope to see in medicine, especially as we progress in our careers, as we progress to become, you know, residents or attendings, that we carry this with us, this idea of community consultation, learning from others, humility, and just the humanity aspect, the compassionate care aspect.
For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Lori.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Wednesday, April 8th. We are going to have a beautiful sunny day here in the city of Kingston. It's going to be cold, but that sunshine will make what normally is a 3-degree day feel closer to 6 degrees. Thursday, April 9th, we're back to that lovely spring weather. Daytime high of 13 degrees in the forecast with just a 25% chance of precipitation. We're going to see mostly cloudy conditions and there will be a decent amount of wind blowing, but still much preferable to what we had. Friday, April 10th, daytime high of 10 degrees with a 65% chance of precipitation, feeling closer to 6 degrees because of the rain. Saturday, April 11th, this is more like it. 14 degrees, mix of sun and cloud. It's going to be a gorgeous spring day. And that's going to follow up into Sunday, March 12th, another double-digit day, 13 with a mostly sunny condition. And starting off next week, Monday, April 13th, we've got a 13-degree day with lots of sun in the forecast. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week, and just bear in mind, winter overnight street parking restrictions have been lifted as of April 1st. We begin with two long-term road closures. Berry Street to Queen is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street, and Aberdeen Street from Johnson to William is closed indefinitely to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. We have some short-term road closures as well, including Wright Crescent at Palace Road, which is closed for a contractor to complete roadway repairs, pedestrian safety and access improvements, and traffic calming features on Wright Crescent. There is a minimal traffic disruption on Bath Road to Sir John A. MacDonald Boulevard. Expect delays for the installation of intersection pedestrian signals. The city is installing intersection pedestrian signals at several locations to make it easier and safer for pedestrians to cross busy roads. They are installing these signals at the following intersections: Bath Road at Lafleur Park, Concession Street at Kings Court Avenue, and Stephen Street at Patrick Street. And that's a wrap for your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Safe driving, everybody.
Looking for something to do this week? This is Christina Lori coming back with K-Town's hottest events and concerts coming up this week, starting with events. On Wednesday, April 8th, weekly board games night takes place at the Royal Canadian Legion at 6, along with karaoke at Time Out Bar, also at 6. Trivia at Daft Brewing starts at 7, and karaoke continues at the Grad Club at 8. On Thursday, April 9th, the Kingston Public Market returns from 8:30 to 5. In the evening, check out Drag Bingo at Daft Brewing, kicking off at 7. There is no shortage of trivia on Thursday, with trivia at Riverhead at 7, the Grad Club at 8, Something in the Water at 8, and Queen's Pub at 9. Karaoke runs at Jersey's at 8:30 and The Buckle at 9. Plus, the Urban Music Social takes place at La Vida Bistro Bar at 9:30. On Friday, April 10th, a quick and cute scrapbook and card class happens at the Tet Center at 6.
Trivia takes place at Wild Wings Kingston at 7, and Spring Awakening hits the Thousand Islands Playhouse in Gananoque at 7:30. Getting into the weekend on Saturday, April 11th, the Kingston Public Market comes back from 8:30 to 5. And if you want to add another shopping stop to your day, the Kingston Botanical Market takes place at the Tet Center from 10 to 3. In the evening, there's a roller skating night at Golden Links Hall in Harrowsmith at 6:30. On Sunday, April 12th, to wrap up the week, the Memorial Center Farmers Market runs from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. A needle-felted landscape workshop takes place at the Tet Center from 10 to 4:30. For those who don't want the weekend to end too soon, karaoke wraps up the night at the Merchant at 8 and keeps going at the Toucan at 10:30. Now getting into your concerts coming up this week. Wednesday, April 8th, DJ Great White spins at Hotel Wolf Island at 4, followed by Sean McCullough at the Coven at 5. The Deep Dark Woods with O'Green will also be playing the Broom Factory at 7:30. On Thursday, April 9th, a midday performance takes place at St. George's Cathedral at 12:15 with Mellow's Choir and Period Instruments, Serene Sounds of the Renaissance. Lauren Carson plays the Coven at 5, Cancer Bats and guests hit the Broom Factory at 6:30, and Jeff Dunn performs at the RCHA at 7. Friday, April 10th is a packed night for music. Here's just a few. Not Guilty, Ali Pester, and Ken Jameson perform at the RCHA at 4. Micah Garvin plays the Toucan at 5. The Red Handed at Timeout at 6. Lucas Oak at the Loaf and Ale at 7. And Heatwave returns to the RCHA at 8. Then the Oreos close out the night at the Merchant at 10:30. On Saturday, April 11th, Dead Root Revival and the Millwrights play at the Broom Factory starting at 7. The Kingston Symphony presents Under Paris Skies with Jill Barber at the Grand Theater at 7:30, alongside the SOS ABBA Experience at the Spire. Tiny Horse performs at Signal Brewery at 8, and Guilty Pleasures take the stage at Tiernanog at 9. On Sunday, April 12th, closing out the week, a youth open mic happens at the Broom Factory at 1, followed by Dawson Gray and Connor Wicklum at 7:30. Castle, Sweetleaf, and Sweet Machete perform at Daft Brewing at 7:30. An Elton John tribute show takes place at the Spire at 7:30, and James Gordon performs at Hotel Wolf Island starting at 8:15. That's just a look at what's happening around Kingston this week. Have an event you'd like to add to our online and on-air calendar? Reach out today via cfrc.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. For more details on these events, check out the full calendars on cfrc.ca. Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Spring is in the air, which means it's time once again for the Banree Foundation's annual spring celebration. Join us as we recognize the incredible achievements of mature women students at Queen's University. The festivities will take place at Grant Hall on May 2nd at 2 p.m. This is a free event and everyone is welcome to attend. Find event details by visiting the Banree Center website, following us on Instagram or Facebook, or emailing brc@queensu.ca. Come celebrate exceptional women with us. See you there.
Are you between 14 and 30 years old and interested in organizing a French language activity for youth in your community? The VIF program can make it happen. You could receive $850 to create your activity, and your partnering organization could get $150 to support it. Bring your idea to life. Visit proclamvif.ca and apply today.
The Office of VP Research offers undergraduate students meaningful opportunities to engage in discovery-based learning and to develop research and presentation skills through their Undergraduate Student Summer Research Fellowship and the Undergraduate Student Research Award. Do you self-identify as a Black or Indigenous person? There are allocated funds through the USRA to help address the disproportionate underfunding of Black and Indigenous scholars at the undergraduate level. All projects are paid full-time work under the guidance of a faculty researcher and run from May through August. Application intake and deadlines are set by each department, so contact your department supervisor today. Application intake and deadlines are set by each department, so contact your department or supervisor today. Access the website to learn more, queensu.ca/VPR/resources/undergraduate. For general inquiries, contact Tracy Allen at allent@queensu.ca. Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer, Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. And welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, on Kingston City Council's final approval of the purchase of the Lemoyne Point Farm.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. With unanimous approval at their last meeting, Council finalized the city's purchase of the Lemoyne Point Farm property for $12 million. The property has been in limbo since the passing of owner Mary Fraser in 2022. In her will, Fraser granted the city the option to purchase the land at 95% of its fair market value, with the condition that it remain as much as possible zoned for rural use. The report from city staff provided to Council at their second March meeting detailed the largely behind-the-scenes process to get to this point. In May 2023, the estate trustees set the price at more than $18 million. The city disputed that figure, and a court application was made by the estate trustees seeking interpretation of parts of the will in 2024. A settlement was reached in February 2026, and the court approved the agreement to sell the property to the city for $12 million. The sale is expected to close in mid-April. Council formally approved up to $12 million in debt financing for the acquisition, with repayment to come from the Municipal Reserve Fund. Councillors around the Horseshoe expressed strong support for the purchase.
There's a lot of joy in the city, and I think they're in the council chambers of this being done, and staff did a tremendous job and deserve a lot of credit and the patience they had to have. And so I just want to echo that, and it's not a reason to be to celebrate, really.
Briefly, I really think it's important that we acknowledge the Save Lemoyne Point Farm group. They did some really incredible advocacy starting back before the 2022 election. They were extremely patient. They were always respectful, both I found with council and with staff, which was really appreciated. And I really also want to acknowledge their initiative. They got out there, they held meetings, they were trying to plan some visioning. They were really trying to get behind what community wants this space to be. So while we're still a ways off from any of those kinds of decisions, thank you. Please thank your group, all the members, but particularly the leadership. You've done exceptional work here, and I hope you're really proud of what you've been able to achieve.
Members of the Save Lemoyne Point Farm group, who have long advocated for the land's protection, were also present at the council meeting, celebrating the step forward while also making clear their work is not over.
We will still be vigilant in the background, but I really want to congratulate the council, and for anyone here who might not realize, I've been involved for 35 years in defending that property, and some people in this community have been involved for longer than that. So there really are a lot of very happy people tonight. Thank you.
City staff say no immediate changes are planned, with future uses to be shaped through a community consultation process over the coming year. Local organizations and partners, including the Cataraqui Region Conservation Authority, have already expressed interest in offering programming on the site. The city says a more detailed engagement plan is in the works, with updates and opportunities for public input to be shared through a dedicated project page on the city's website. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to CFRC's Henry Walker with a story by Michelle Dory Forstell, LJR reporter for the Kingstonist, about the Transplant Advocate Association's local efforts to close the gap on organ donation.
Thank you, Dinah. A Napanee man who survived a near-fatal heart attack and years of serious illness is now using his experience to urge others to register as organ donors. Richard Hogan's story is being highlighted by the Transplant Advocate Association, TAA, as part of its Be a Donor Month campaign, which runs throughout April and includes events across eastern Ontario. According to a TAA release, Hogan was walking his dog on Christmas Eve in 2018 when he began to feel chest pain. What he initially dismissed as anxiety turned out to be a massive heart attack, known as a widowmaker, caused by a blockage in a critical artery, a condition with a low survival rate without immediate treatment. Thanks to his family calling 911, paramedics arrived quickly and rushed him to hospital. Hogan survived, but in the years that followed, Hogan faced a series of compounding health issues, including cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, and heart failure. A visit to the Ottawa Heart Institute in September of 2020 left him with two options: a wristy surgery to have an artificial heart pump installed, or a heart transplant. Rich chose the transplant, thinking it was his best chance at a prolonged life. According to the association, Hogan received a donor heart just 2 days after being placed on the transplant list, a turnaround that allowed him to return to daily life and be present for major family milestones, including his children's graduations and an upcoming wedding. Hogan has since become involved with TAA as a volunteer and board member, part of what the organization describes as a network of recipients, donors, and families working to raise awareness about organ and tissue donation. TAA notes that Hogan's story underscores a broader issue. While public support for organ donation is high, registration rates remain comparatively low. Ontario continues to rely on an opt-in system, a model donation advocates have long criticized as a barrier to higher registration rates. Data from the Trillium Gift of Life Network shows that more than 90% of eligible Ontarians say they support organ donation, but only about 35% are formally registered. That gap has profound consequences. More than 1,700 people in Ontario are currently waiting for life-saving organ transplants, while thousands more are waiting for tissue donations, according to the association. One organ donor can save up to 8 lives and enhance up to 75 others through tissue donation, the group said in its campaign materials. Still, many patients die waiting for a match. The Transplant Advocate Association, a regional charity serving Kingston, Frontenac, Lennox, and Addington, and surrounding counties, says its work focuses on both awareness and direct support. Members, many of whom have lived experiences with transplantation, provide peer support and practical guidance to patients and families navigating the process, including what to expect before and after surgery and how to manage travel and accommodation costs. While transplant surgeries are covered by the province, the organization notes that many associated costs are not, creating additional financial pressures for families. Throughout April, TAA volunteers will host information booths, attend community events, and work with municipalities to promote Be a Donor Month. Flag raising and proclamation events are planned for Napanee and Kingston on April 7th, with local officials expected to attend. April 7th also marks Green Shirt Day, a national campaign created in honor of Humboldt Broncos player Logan Boulay, whose organ donation in 2018 helped save 6 lives and led to a surge in donor registrations across Canada. Registering matters. Ontario operates on an opt-in system, meaning residents must actively register their consent to donate. Advocates say that can lead to confusion, with some people assuming they are already registered based on past documentation that may no longer apply. In Ontario, registering to become an organ and tissue donor is a quick process that can be done online through beadonor.ca, their registration page. You must be at least 16 years old and have a valid Ontario health card. The process takes just a couple of minutes and involves entering basic information such as your date of birth and health card number, then recording your consent through the Secure Service Ontario system. You can also check your registration status to see if it still is active. If you'd prefer, you can also register in person at a Service Ontario location or by mailing in a consent form. Once registered, your decision is stored with the Ministry of Health, and it's recommended that you also share your wishes with family so they can honor them when the time comes. For Hogan, whose life depended on a donor's decision, the message is straightforward. Registration, he says, is what turns support into action, and ultimately into lives saved.
Thank you, Henry, and to Michelle Dory Forrestel of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little, LGI reporter for CJPE County FM, on a recent workshop for potential municipal candidates in the Prince Edward County elections.
Having an interest to serve your municipality is commendable, but what does it entail? What are the responsibilities of a councillor or a mayor? How much do they get paid, and how much time is involved? Only a few of the many questions potential candidates might have before filling out the nomination papers. Prince Edward County wants new blood in the council chamber, so presented a workshop for potential candidates last night, where attendees learned about the three levels of government and how they interact with municipal politics. They heard details about roles and responsibilities of the various key players and obligations of the councillors. As a bonus, two former councillors were present to share their experiences campaigning and serving as councillors and former mayor. The jobs of councillors and mayor are listed as part-time and thus reflected in the remuneration. The veteran councillors were open to questions and gave honest answers. Former Mayor Quaife didn't mince words when he said that 60 hours a week wasn't uncommon. Municipal Clerk Catalina Blumenberg tells us about the event. Catalina, could you tell me why you were running this event tonight?
This event tonight was really important to ensure people who are thinking about running for office know what they're really getting into so that they can make an informed decision. It's important to know what it entails, the type of work that they would be involved in, how the process works. Governance can be, you know, a big machinery, so what is that like? And just so that they feel supported, too, through their campaign process and to know that the clerk's office is a resource for them and that we're here to help them through their campaign.
And what areas were you talking about tonight?
We went through the roles and responsibilities of a member of council and a head of council, the mayor's role. We talked about the municipal powers, the role of staff as well, so that candidates have an understanding of how that works. But I think what was really interesting and different about tonight was they got to learn insights from people who have actually ran for office and were successful and were on previous previous councils. And I thought that that really connected the presentation portion of the workshop, and then to have that real firsthand experience to share their stories, their successes, their failures, and what surprised them about being a member of council. I really hope that this was an event that people can have true takeaways as they're thinking about running for office.
I asked a couple of attendees their reasons for coming to the workshop, and they had this to say.
Just curiosity. I was wondering what it takes to become a counselor. I don't know if I'm going to run or not, but I was just also curious to know.
But it's in your mind to maybe run.
Yeah, like I said, I was just curious.
And did it satisfy your curiosity?
It was interesting.
What brought you to the event tonight?
I just wanted to learn more about the process and honestly wanted to maybe make some contact with some people who were maybe thinking of running and seeing what they wanted to do for the county.
And were you happy with the event tonight?
Yeah, it was wonderful. It's always nice to hear from some old veteran politicians and just to see some people sitting around a table wanting to make the county a better place.
Attendees felt they were satisfied with the information, but were noncommittal about running for office. For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Up next, we have Juliana Gonsalves reading a story by Owen Fullerton, LGI reporter for YGK News on Kingston-led research on healthy shoulder motion.
Thank you, Dinah. Researchers at Kingston Health Sciences Center and Queen's University's Smith Engineering have released findings that could present a major step towards an evolved understanding of joint health and injuries. The first of its kind study in Canada is using advanced imaging technology to get a more complete picture of how the human shoulder moves, providing insights that could be used to make impactful changes in injury prevention, rehabilitation, and reparative surgery. The study was conducted at the Skeletal Observation Laboratory at Hôtel Dieu and uses biplanar video radiography, BVR for short, to accurately view the shoulder bones moving underneath the skin in real time. Aaron Lee, lead author of the study and former PhD student at Queen's, says that still X-ray images have typically been used when studying the shoulder, which forces assumptions to be made about how bones are moving relative to how the skin is moving. With a joint as dynamic as the shoulder, she says that often results in errors in the calculations made. What's really novel about this equipment that we're using is it allows us to see how the bones are moving directly, Lee said. Especially in joints like the shoulder, if you just feel your shoulder blade, you can feel that the shoulder blade, it moves a lot beneath the skin. The system used for imaging is not common, with the lab being one of the only two in Canada boasting the equipment due to its complex setup and the technical expertise needed to make use of it. Michael Rainbow, the director of the Skeletal Observation Laboratory and an associate professor of mechanical and materials engineering at Queen's, has previously used the imaging technology to explore the fundamental movement of the foot and ankle, another area of the body containing a bevy of different bones. Because of the complexity of the shoulder joint, it has been understudied, and Dr. Rainbow says that can lead to a somewhat misguided approach to injury treatment. This is the kind of research that allows us to revisit long-standing assumptions about how the human body works. Many of those assumptions have shaped treatment strategies, yet they were made before we could directly measure skeletal motion, Rainbow said in a press release. This kind of study is essential for designing better treatments in the future. Lee, whose PhD studies focused on shoulder motion and mechanics, says there are two primary goals to the research that could help reshape injury prevention and recovery. The first goal, and the focus of the published findings, is to discover and implement a better understanding of the function of a healthy shoulder, but that the imaging technology could one day also more closely explore the differences in shoulder function between individuals. It's mainly just generally what are the patterns we see across our samples, but then also how much does that vary across people, Lee said. On average, for every amount of 5 degrees you raise your arm, you might see 2.5 degrees of how much your scapula rotates. But with our technology, we can really get at that with more granularity and see if there is any differences across people, and we absolutely find that people vary. We're not all the same, and we don't all move the same, and that has relevance for later on disease progression as well. Given the rarity of these machines, individuals won't soon be able to know exactly how their own shoulders move, but the discoveries could help to inform treatment plans in professions like physiotherapy sooner than later. Lee says, with so many assumptions made about the healthy motion of a shoulder, some best courses of treatment might actually be damaging to certain individuals rather than helpful. She says the research could ultimately give the field more tools to work with to support more individualized recovery plans. With any sort of treatment, there are some patients who benefit from it and some patients who don't. So I think that this is the kind of research where we can get into the more individuality part of it and see how people vary. A lot of those assumptions are based off of how we think the healthy shoulder works, but really we haven't fully uncovered that. So we're kind of early in this knowledge to action plan, where right now we're trying to uncover, is there really such thing as this healthy movement pattern?
Thank you, Juliana. Coming up, we have a story by Keith Dempsey, local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, on Gananoque fire and rescue training. In a township defined by rugged shorelines, wooded trails, and hard-to-reach backcountry, firefighters are training for the moments when every second and every step matter. Members of the Leeds Thousand Islands Fire Service have spent recent days advancing towards their NFPA 1001 Firefighter Level 2 certification, honing critical skills designed to strengthen emergency response across the municipality. Last Monday night, crews from stations 3 and 4 came together for a focused session on equipment familiarization and off-road patient transfer techniques, including the use of utility task vehicles, or UTVs.
The training reflects a practical reality in the township of Leeds in the Thousand Islands, where emergencies often unfold far from paved roads. Firefighters work through simulated scenarios involving injured individuals in remote areas, practicing how to stabilize, package, and safely extract patients from uneven or isolated terrain, conditions commonly found among the township's extensive network of hiking trails. Officials said the exercises are about more than meeting certification requirements. They are aimed at ensuring crews can respond quickly and effectively, regardless of location or conditions. With the busy tourism season approaching, the department officials continue to emphasize ongoing training as a cornerstone of public safety, ensuring both residents and visitors can rely on a highly prepared emergency response team when it matters most. In other news, a member of the Gananoque Police Service is being recognized nationally for his community outreach efforts, with praise now coming from both police and municipal leaders. Sergeant Mike Driscoll has received the inaugural Volunteer of the Year Award from Keep Canada Fishing, recognizing his work connecting with residents through local programs. Throughout his career, Driscoll has been dedicated to serving the Gananoque community, particularly through initiatives such as Kids and Cops Fishing Days. The program brings together youth, families, and police in a relaxed setting, helping build trust and strengthen relationships outside of traditional policing. In a statement, the town of Gananoque also congratulated Driscoll, highlighting his role in creating meaningful connections with local youth and families while sharing his passion for fishing. The award was presented during the Toronto Sportsman Show, where Driscoll was recognized alongside others in the outdoor and conservation community. Officials say the honor reflects both Driscoll's long-standing commitment to community service and the broader impact of outreach-focused policing initiatives.
Thank you, Jesse, and now right back over to you with the latest in local sports.
Thank you, Dinah. The 2026 edition of the Queen's University Athletics and Recreation Color Awards were held late last week in the main gym of the Athletics and Recreation Center. The Color Awards recognize outstanding accomplishments on both the club and team level. Starting with the varsity clubs, the Queen's cheerleading team was recognized with the Award of Merit as the Varsity Club of the Year. 2025-26 was a historic season for Queen's Cheer, who took home a national title alongside the National Judges' Choice Award. Nathan Duffer Calder took home the Jack Jarvis Trophy as the top male athlete amongst varsity clubs for his contributions to the university's sailing team. Abby Lee of Queen's Lacrosse was awarded the Marion Ross Trophy as the top female clubs athlete. Night 2 put the focus on varsity teams. Jude Wheeler D of Queen's Cross Country was the Outstanding Performance of the Year recipient following a career season for the cross country and track teams. Wheeler D was named the OUA Cross Country Male Runner of the Year and was an integral member of the National Champion Cross Country team. He also won 2 gold medals as a distance runner at the U Sports Track and Field Championships in the 1500 and 3000 meter events. Internationally, Wheeler D won a gold medal in the 1500 meter event at the Junior Pan American Championships while representing Canada in the summer of 2025, setting a new meet record. Quote, Jude will graduate from Queen's as its greatest male distance and middle distance athlete, said Queen's cross country and distance track head coach Mark Bomba. Queen's football defensive back Ashton Miller-Melançon took home the Jenkins Trophy as the Varsity Male Athlete of the Year, a fitting result for one of the most prolific players in Queen's football's 140-year history. Miller-Melançon ended his 5-year tenure with the Gaels as a 4-time OUA All-Star and a 2-time All-Canadian, and his final career interception total was 22, the most in program history. Miller-Melançon was drafted by the Calgary Stampeders in the 2025 CFL Draft and will be heading out west to begin his professional football career. The 2025 Gaels football team won the Jim Tate Award as the top overall varsity team. This comes on the heels of their historic Yates Cup victory over the number one ranked seed in the country, the Laurier Golden Hawks. This Yates Cup win was the first in 16 years and gave the football team a chance to play in the Mitchell Bowl against the Saskatchewan Huskies. They would ultimately lose that game by a score of 22-11.
Thank you to Jesse Bell for that update, and also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Wednesday, April 8th, a little warmer. We've got sunny conditions here in the city of Kingston, but just a top end temperature of 3 degrees, so bundle up if you're going to be outside. Thursday, April 9th, 11 degrees is your forecast with about an 85% chance of precipitation, going to feel closer to 7 degrees given all the rain. Friday, April 10th, 7 degrees is your top-end temperature with a low of 2 and about a 55% chance of precipitation in the forecast. Saturday, April 11th, the first double-digit day of the week. We've got partly sunny conditions. 10 is your high, but it's actually going to feel a degree warmer right around 11. Sunday, April 12th, 11 degrees is your high with an overnight low of 7. We have sunny conditions in the morning, but increasing cloudiness into the afternoon and evening. Monday, April 13th, daytime high of 14 degrees with a 75% chance of precipitation and an overnight low of 7.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Just don't go wasting your confidence.
would still make sense.